Happy birthday and happy New Year's. Hello, I am Will Morgan, and this is 42 Minutes, a production of SyncBook Radio and thesyncbook.com, a weekly conversation with the interesting artists and syncers of our day. Today is the 31st of December and the end of the line for 2013. Our episode this morning marks our 117th podcast and our very last one for this year. We couldn't think of anyone more special to share it with than with the birthday boy himself.
Think of it. The brightest star visible from our planet reaches its highest point above the horizon at midnight every New Year's Eve. How wonderful, how poetic, almost like a cosmic reminder that this most brilliant of stellar lights is welcoming in and shining the new year, giving us all hope for a bright new beginning. Good morning, friends. Doug here, and today on 42 Minutes, we welcome Alan Abadesa Green, editor of the SyncBook and managing editor of SyncBook Press. He's the author of 2011's Look at All the Happy Creatures and is the individual behind the forthcoming SyncBook Press title Suicide Kings, of which we spoke last spring in episode number 77 and which we can likely expect from SyncBook Press in 2014. Alan is one of the roundtable hosts for the SyncBook radio program Always Record, as well as being the co-founder and co-host of the Synchronicity audio magazine Synchronize. He's had a direct hand in all four of the initial SyncBook Press books, and most recently assisted editor Jason Barrera with SyncBook Press's latest title, The Yogic Gospel of Thomas. More information about Alan and his work can be found at his website, allthehappycreatures.com. It's Alan's birthday today, and we need to begin here. Happy birthday, Alan, and welcome back to 42 Minutes.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me back, and thank you for wishing me a happy birthday and happy new year to both of you guys.
And so how old are you today?
33.
And what does this mean?
Absolutely nothing.
I guess I graduate to the Illuminati today.
All right. Well, so we have to start here. Your birthday's New Year's Eve, and then I found this thing by Jack Horkheimer about Sirius, and you've had a connection to Sirius. Can you talk about your own through line, your own mythology, and what is up with you and Sirius?
The short answer is I don't really know. I mean, I have these series of experiences. Bear in mind, this was before I found out about Robert Anton Wilson and Timothy Leary, et cetera, like all the people who have had these Sirius experiences. I don't know. I think the closest I might have come to really feeling like an influence from Sirius, I don't even know if I read it at that point, but I was a big fan of Voltaire's writings, and he has this book, Micromegas, a short story called Micromegas, which, of course, Voltaire's connections to masonry and all that sort of stuff, it's not surprising, but it's a short story about these beings from Sirius. That's the only place I could think, if you want to chalk it up to subconscious infiltration or something. But the more direct answer is that back in, 2010, the year we made contact, I did seem to make contact with something. I had this week-long experience where I was having these different dreams, and each one was about something trying to convey a message or beam a message into my head, as crazy as that sounds. And in the dreams, it was this connection to Sirius, and every night it was a different variation on it. One night it was specifically a message from Sirius that was made clear to me. And this happened for about a week straight, and finally I said, hey, I asked the experience, what's the deal here? If you're trying to tell me something or if you have the ability to show me something, prove it. And the next day I was standing in a store by a lotto machine, and these numbers popped into my head so overwhelmingly clear that I was like, all right, screw it, even though I don't normally play the lotto. Bear in mind, this was 50 cents. If I had more money in my pocket, I could be a rich man right now. But I'm usually a broke guy. And I was like, oh, I have 50 cents, whatever, I could put down a small bet. And I ended up winning $2,500 and suddenly realized that something very real was happening here. I've had a number of really weird experiences that have only gotten more bizarre as they went on, but each time being able to offer me some sort of very verifiable information. So, again, is this tapping into some sort of Akashic field or my right brain, the collective unconscious? Is it actually a message from Sirius? I don't know. But where I'd kind of like to take this today is that we did... When did we do that Sink in the City event? We did that event in New York. And that was my question to Radio 8-Ball was, hey, I'm having these Sirius experiences. What does it mean? You know, what is my connection to Sirius? And the answer was Andras Jones' song, Action, which Andras tells me that I completely misinterpreted his song. And at the same time, you know, he's the guy who will tell you that there's no way to misinterpret an answer because it's all, you know, meaningful to you.
No, that was a strange answer, too, because... All right, so we go back in time. This is like January 31st, 2011, I think. Or maybe it was 2012. 2012? It was the beginning. Yep, that's what it was. But it was the end of...
For the Radio 8-Ball, you mean. The Sink in the City was the beginning of 2012.
Yes. And then you ask the question, and the song is saying, I don't want your words, I want your action.
Correct, yeah. And, you know, whatever popped into my head at the moment, I mean, I've had at this point, I guess, almost 2 years to think about it. And it does seem to be, I don't know if it's exactly what Sirius, where Sirius fits into that, but it's, you know, it seems to sum up my... I don't know, my skill set, what makes me in any way valuable to this sync community. When I first started blogging and stuff, Doug, after we got to know each other, you said to me, when you first saw my website and everything, you said, where is this guy coming from that he suddenly has this infrastructure and he's got a whole website and all this sort of stuff? And, you know, I think people look at the work that's put out and assume that there's like a team working or something, you know, and we'll get there, but now I have help from a few more people, but basically I'm just a guy who won't sleep and, you know, drinks a lot of coffee, smokes a lot of cigarettes and just keeps working. And that seems to be I'm able to bring to the table here is a really strong work ethic and just someone who wants to get shit done. You know, it's like I hear all these people talking about, oh, it would be great if we did this. It would be great if we had a book. It would be great if we had radio shows. It would be great if we had whatever. It's like, okay, we could do that.
How did Andras interpret the answer and how did you interpret it differently?
Oh.
Do you remember that?
I was saying that the guy singing the song sounds like an asshole, which is what he took offense to because he's the one singing the song. I'm like no, the character.
Right.
I mean, I don't think of it as of Andras. It's like if I wrote a story, that's not me talking. That's a character talking. Especially if you're doing your job right. So I felt like the character, if you will, the voice of the song was a little bit of an asshole, and he got all offended that I was calling him an asshole and whatever. I guess what I was saying was it just made me realize that I was sort of denying, I don't know, maybe being a lack of gratefulness or something, that this experience, and I take this into a wider scope of being, you know, the universe, the Godhead, the divine feminine, all these sort of things that we could associate with Sirius. It's like it's doing something for me, or it's offering me this wonderful vision, but at the same time it's asking of me to hold up my end of the bargain. You know, without empty words to bring action to the table and actually act on this stuff. So that was how I basically interpreted it. And I think what he was saying I misinterpreted was that the guy, the voice of the song was in some way wrong or, you know, not holding up his end of the bargain.
So this is from Philip K. Dick's Exegesis, folder 38-4. If anybody ever reads the Exegesis, it's separated into folders. So this is the fourth entry in folder 38. It says, "I was taken over by a superior life form, which was interfering with history. What am I supposed to do? How am I supposed to go on day by day?" So it's interesting because I've been reading the Exegesis for a while now, but I kind of go back to it every once in a while. And it seems that he plays with this idea that he was influenced. And if anybody knows Philip K. Dick, a lot of times he comes to the idea of Sirius in his work. But it seems like he was convinced that, like he wrote Flow My Tears. And in this, it seems that after he wrote Flow My Tears, he had his experience. Flow My Tears wasn't in the experience, but the experience taught him how to read Flow My Tears, as if it was teaching him that he wasn't the total source for the novel. Do you get what I'm saying? And it sounds like a lot like what you're presenting here, by somehow you're being influenced. And we can talk about it all day, but it actually, you know, am I wrong in assessing that your experience came while you were in the midst of action on SyncBook, or before SyncBook, or?
I wasn't doing SyncBook yet, but I was doing, I had started blogging. I mean, my website at that time was more conspiracy oriented. I was still working on Look at All the Happy Creatures, and I don't know. I mean, you know, one of the things I do consider, though, is that in Look at All the Happy Creatures, the sort of main narrator, if you will, is this character. His name is Zabu, the sun-stroked dog.
I was just looking at Zabu because you were talking about voices, but we'll get to that in a minute. Go on, please.
Oh, just to say, this idea of being like in the story, it's sort of a an offensive name given to him, is that he's the sun-stroked dog, as if anything he could say would be the voice of delirium. That he's sun-stroked, implying that he's, you know, obviously anything he says is inane or insane.
He's a crazy dog,
right? Because obviously he's talking about, you know, fighting the system or being sovereign and independent.
Maybe we need to break in and say, okay, so look at All the Happy Creatures. What's the basic premise and why?
Just think of it as a sci-fi animal farm is the easiest way to say it. They're talking animals, and they're in like a 1984 Philip K. Dick dystopian future. And and this dog is sort of the voice of the, you know, revolution, if you will. I'm oversimplifying it, but, you know, just to say. Anyway, what I realized is that this idea of this dog being this sort of voice, and that he's the sunstroke dog, I couldn't help but think of what the Masons refer to Sirius, which is the dog star, as the blazing star, right? It's this idea that, what is Sirius? Is the scorcher or something?
Yes.
So, you know, here we have this blazing sun dog. I don't know, it's just not that big of a leap for me, even, you know, discounting what some of the leaps we take with synchronicity. I'm just saying this to me is significant. So I was writing that at the time, and I had just started to look into the mythology of Osiris, which at the time I didn't even realize was connected to Sirius. I mean, I had just started my investigation into Osiris. So to me, if anything, one of the things I think about is sort of almost like, if you want to think of it as a video game mentality, it's like you unlock certain archetypes, and does it unlock certain parts of your brain or access to certain, I don't know, cosmic information? I don't want to get like too, you know, new agey, but I mean this very seriously. Like, are you unlocking some sort of archetype? And I had just started to investigate something. So obviously in Look at All the Happy Creatures, I'm kind of tapping into it unconsciously. And then with the blog, when I started doing some sync work and looking at the mythology and the architecture of Osiris, I start to unlock a conscious approach to this. And it seemed that combination seems to have opened a kind of floodgate.
Okay, so you were talking earlier about the asshole voice of Andras Jones' action song. And you were talking about how you separate, you know, the characters and how you speak with the characters and the voices that they take on. Zabu seems to be more of your voice. Like, if there was a voice that I recognize through my friendship with you, it would be Zabu. Is that a true
statement?
That's
so funny. You said that to me when you started reading the book, you know, I don't know, a few months ago, you said that to me, and that really surprised me, because Zabu was supposed to be like the Obi-Wan, you know, he was like, he's supposed to be the old knowledgeable guy, and I thought of myself as, if I identified with a character, it was definitely Oompa, the monkey, who's more of the sort of Luke Skywalker young fool that's just kind of like angry and frustrated and yet in love and trying to do his best in that, and then seeking the advice of the Zabu. So
Zabu speaks with a little bit of poetry. Like, the parts that Zabu are in, there's a good fluidity and groundedness to the book. However, like, just about all the other characters are so naive.
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm saying. I don't know. I guess I think of I think of myself as a bit naive in that respect.
All right, so we've got our serious theme going on with our dog and our dog star. Could you quickly relate what Sirius has to do to Christmas, and then what he has to do with Osiris also, just for more breadth in this?
I guess Christmas, the most basic thing to say would be, obviously we have the idea of the three magi. You know, it's like the three magi follow the brightest star, the star in the east, to this risen child, right? Well, if you look up in the sky, you have the constellation of Osiris. What we call Orion, what to the Egyptians was Osiris. And there's those three belt stars that are really easy to spot in the sky. And those three belt stars, which, of course, guys like, what is it, Robert Bouval has connected to the three pyramids of Egypt, that these align and stuff like that. Well, these
three wise men.
Yeah, exactly. They are the three magi, and they point. If you look up in the sky, you look at those belt stars and follow them diagonally down into the left, back into the left, you can follow those and you will see Sirius is very, very close. It is the brightest star in the sky. And you just follow those three belt stars down into the left and you'll see Sirius. So here we have this connection of it's pointing to where Sirius rises. Obviously you have There's a solar aspect to Christmas, you know, with the sun will be essentially at its low point around the winter solstice, stay there for 3 days, and then rise again, and all this sort of stuff that you can kind of play with. Of course, you have to realize that Sirius is both esoterically and perhaps astrologically connected to the sun, meaning, like, theosophists consider Sirius to be the spiritual sun, and things like that. So this it's almost like the second sun. And here we have, I myself am actually, I guess, the second sun. I just said that right now. It's interesting. In my family, it's just me and my brother. So he's an older brother. So I guess I am the second sun. But basically, this connection to Christmas, you also, here's something that doesn't get talked about a lot. There, in the myth of Osiris, right, he gets killed by his brother and put in this box, and then this box drifts down the Nile, and then this tree grows around it, and Isis finds him in, he just to dig him out from under this tree in this box. And something I think about is that at Christmas, what do? But open boxes at the bottom of a tree. Again, it's just a little something, but it's something that I never hear anyone talk about.
Yeah, and so one of the other things that I've never completely verified, but Sirius actually points to where the sun is going to be born on Christmas Day by following those three magi pointers to Sirius. Like, that's one of those big astrological moments. And then also, Sirius in Egypt, when it rises in the summer, that's when the flooding began. Like, somehow that was how they were able to calculate when it would flood.
Yeah, right. So their calendar was based around Sirius, and there's the argument to be made that the Gregorian calendar is also based around Sirius. Like you've mentioned, the idea that Sirius is at its highest point on the new year for our calendar. I mean, the question would be, is that an accident? You know, is that cosmic poetry, or is that an intentional choice to make yet another calendar based on Sirius?
Look at all the happy creatures is kind of a conspiracy. I mean, where do you stand with that now? So we're talking about calendars and intention, and then also sync is just, you know, poetry. What?
I always come back to the answer that it's both. I mean, to me, when someone says conspiracy, it just means, is it intentional? Is it a conscious choice to do this? And of course, I mean, you said, hey, can you be on Skype at 11 a.m. Tuesday morning on your birthday? And I said, yes, we have a conscious choice to conspire to meet this morning to do this show. To discredit, I think it's, you know, like Alan Watt had this thing years ago that said, like, you know, once you reach a certain level, you realize that there is no such thing as causality. I mean, I strongly disagree with that. Of course there's causality. Of course there's intent. It's what makes us human. I mean, unless you want to completely throw out any idea of free will, am I just destined to, you know, flow on this course? And even if I did, I mean, I was just rereading the Watchmen graphic novel. It's so funny to see, you know, Dr. Manhattan, and it's like, well, yeah, I am choosing to do this, and it's preordained. You know, it's he's saying, oh, you're about to tell me about such and such. And then the person says, well, then you already know about it. And he's like, well, no, I won't know until you tell me. And it's just sort of playing with this idea of that it's somehow both free will and yet also there is a nonlinear sense of time. So, of course, I believe in a cosmic poetry of synchronicity. I also think that a lot of times things are expressed unconsciously. That doesn't mean Chris Knowles, one of the things that I really like that the way he worded this is to say it's not a question of intentional or unintentional, but conscious or unconscious, meaning, well, maybe I didn't consciously know about Sirius, maybe I wasn't consciously putting this stuff in there, but there's some part of me that was. You know, does Zabu, that voice of the higher self, is that like the daemon? You know, is that something? Is that something else speaking through you that you're not conscious of? Yeah, exactly. So I'm very open to all those things, but I get frustrated. Basically, for me, the conspiracy crowd frustrates me because they think everything is intentionally planned and masterminded by a group of conscious human beings that have, you know, everything planned out. And, you know, the Ozymandias that's got it all under control. And then you have the sync crowd who thinks, oh, it's all just a beautiful accident. You know, it just happened. Oh, look how that happened. And I fall squarely in the middle saying both of these things are true. There are people who plan things, but not everything is a conscious intent. And yeah, there's some things that are unexplainable from a human standpoint. There are some things that are just cosmic poetry. I'm one of the people that likes to sometimes make the distinction between the two, and on a zoomed out Zen level, I understand if someone wants to say there's really no difference. It's a bit of a paradox or a bit of a poetry in itself that it's somehow both.
Well, you were talking about the voice of Zabu. I kind of want to put you on the spot this morning. You have an intention in 2014 to... Okay, so look at all the happy creatures. This is the first book that you did. And since then, you've done 4 books for Sync Book Press, and they keep becoming more and more accomplished. And so your technique and your skill is growing, and you're creating these beautiful products that are not products, but, you know, artifacts, or, you know, they're beautiful little objects. And look at all the happy creatures once some love.
Well, the idea is that, all right, there's two factors that go into this. One is that when I wrote Look at All the Happy Creatures, it is a dark and brutal book. I mean, it is about as dark as you can get. I've had so many people say to me they couldn't make it past, you know, 30 pages or so, that it was just too brutal and too dark. You know, writing that, the only way I can explain to you what it was like to write that is if you watch the movie Amadeus, and where Amadeus is being commissioned to write this funeral dirge that in order to do it right, he has to completely embody, you know, the room 237 darkness, and it's kind of killing him. Well, to write this was so hard on me that when I was done, I was like, all right, I'm done. That's out. It was like, you know, purging the nastiest virus from my body. Hey, it's done. I don't ever want to look back.
Well, it's a nasty book, man.
Yeah. So
it's aggressive. Hot pokers up buttholes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I heard that happened when Bram Stoker wrote Dracula. He took on the personality of Dracula. I mean, was this so emotional that it was overladen, or because it's very conspiratorial, it's very dark, it's almost pessimistic. Are you against the book now, or do you feel that the book is...
No, I don't want to change, like, I don't want to change the spirit of the book. I think it's actually, even though it doesn't really say where I am right now, I think it's a really solid testament to what that headspace looks like. You know, it's like when you look at it's why I can look at a Jon Ervin and sometimes, yeah, I get annoyed at his aggressive attacks at us. And at the same time, I can't get that upset because I really sympathize with what it's like to be in that dark, paranoid headspace and to see that, just to view the world as that everything's against you.
But it's not that strange in the scheme of things because there's so much apocalyptic fiction right now. In terms of like revolutions and just darkness. So like we went and saw The Hunger Games last night, which is a really dark story, but for some reason, you know, it has really taken hold of popular imagination.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I've never seen the movie or read the books of The Hunger Games. I can't really comment on that, but
it's kids killing kids.
Right.
Yeah.
Because there's some fascist regime that is trying to hold everyone in check, and they need sacrifices to keep things, you know, to keep their central authority. I mean, so can readers of Look at All the Happy Creatures find hope and solace, or is this more Greek?
I hope.
Is it a tragedy?
I think it's both. There's a line in the book where, you know, there's a few lines in the book where it's mentioned that the universe exists in both the absolute darkness, the most brutal, horrible thing you can think of exists in this world, and yet the most beautiful and loving and bright thing in this world also exists, and that you have to recognize both. To deny one or the other is to be living, you know, unconsciously. So I guess what I try really hard to show a bright side and to show a dark side, and hopefully I did a good job of conveying both the hope and the love and the beautiful possibilities alongside these most brutal and dark actions. That was my intent, and obviously the dark stuff will always tend to overshadow anything else. It's true when you turn on the news at night or anything. It's just sort of what we react more strongly to, which is unfortunate. But I want to just kind of take this back. So what I was starting to say is the reason you asked why would I revisit this. So I said when I finished writing it, it was so hard for me to do that I just wanted to be done. I've never even spell-checked, proofread, rewritten. I never went back and touched the book. It was like, it's done, it just is. Now, there's something pure in that. Like, I don't want to compare myself to the writing of Sinclair Lewis. I think he's a genius writer. But when he wrote his book, It Can't Happen Here, which it's funny because Look at All the Happy Creatures, the original title was It Happened Here, as in... Like it was taking place after it had already happened. It was a direct reference to Sinclair Lewis. When he wrote that, that book is still to this day, if you buy a copy of It Can't Happen Here in a bookstore, it's full of typos and it's pretty sloppy. And it's because he was so afraid of coming fascism that he poured this book out of him as quickly as he could and a hope to do something. And that was actually the same fevered pace in which I wrote Happy Creatures. So part of me feels like to touch that would ruin the pureness of it. But at the same time, when you say, with everything I've done for Sync Book Press, basically I've spent months and months and months and months on other people's books to make sure that they are as good as can be. And I've spoken to people and said, hey, this right here, this could be better, you know, or oh, let's just find as, you know, you can keep finding typos and little things. Make sure that the book design and the interior layout is done right and looks good and is easy to read. All the attention and work that I've put into other people's stuff, I feel like it's time for me to be a little more selfish and put some of that love and attention and hard work that I put into making everyone else look great into making my own stuff that was my passion and my work. I want that to shine as well. So it's those two factors, both the fact that it was never really done right in the first place, and I've always kind of regretted that, and also having a few years' experience of really feeling like I've given all my love away. Like, you know, I've given all my hard work to making other people's projects as strong as they could be.
Now, this book has a lot in common, as I'll explain in just a second, with another book that we just finished reading called by Douglas Lane, the Billy Moon book, because on one side you have this stark, harsh reality, and on the other side there's a lot of psychedelic and dream world going on. It reminds me a lot of Moonchild by Aleister Crowley when they visit the astral realm. I want to ask you how difficult it was to take yourself as a writer out of reality when the characters in your story kind of see it dissolve around them.
Oh, I find fiction so much easier to write. You know, when you're it's like when you're trying to write for reality, you're so limited. Trying to like Suicide Kings, every, you know, three paragraphs I'll have to stop for 15 hours to double check and fact check every, you know, just this one sentence. Like, well, is that really the way I want to say that? And let me take the next 3 days to research that just for that one sentence to make sure that's right. With fiction, you can say whatever the hell you want. And as far as the non-reality stuff, I mean, particularly for someone who and still is fascinated by psychedelic and altered states or non-ordinary states or whatever we want to call these, I find that the most fun. I really like abstractions. And I just hope, I don't know, I hope they're fun to read, or they read as interesting. I hope they come across that way.
Are they based on real life experiences?
Some of them are, you know. So here's the thing with Look at All the Happy Creatures. A lot of the brutal stuff that happens in the book, this, here's a detail that no one ever wants to touch, is that a lot of the brutal stuff in that book is all based on real factual things that have happened to people in our war on terror and all this sort of stuff. Every time someone says, oh my God, I can't read about that detail, it's like, well, that's a shame, because that's actually happening. And if you're upset about it happening to a fictional character in a fictional book, well, then you should be pretty upset that it's happening to a real, you know, 6-year-old girl in Afghanistan. And that's, you know, I have no sympathy for anyone who says, I can't handle that. Well, that's real.
That's the cognitive dissonance,
yeah.
That we're all facing every day.
So the brutality, I would say 90-something percent of the things that happen in the book are based on very real events. Not necessarily to me, but very real events. However, there are also things, like there's a scene in there, it's called a chapter called Jimmy Goler's Dream. I mean, that's straight up a dream I had. I had this crazy dream one night, and I woke up and I wrote it down, and then I just worked it into the book. There's a scene in there where Oompa and Tangerine, they go to this astral realm, and they're playing this game to sort of learn how to navigate the astral realm.
And they game play of this love game. And a house of card?
Correct, yeah, where they're they're guessing cards, trying not, like if you just have a card on a table and you're trying to guess what card it is. That was based on my wife and I spending a few months. We just spent like trying to do that, just, you know, trying, you know, okay, one of us holds a card, let's see if the other one can guess it. And actually with really interesting results. So that's based on an actual game that I played with my wife, and that was very loving and fun. And I felt like that a real bonding experience. There's other things like that. There's the scene where I think it's Zabu tells this story about a man and a woman, like the first man and woman creating the universe for each other as a place to live. I had, my wife and I had moved into this apartment, and we had these like glow-in-the-dark plastic stars, and that we were, you know, hanging on the ceiling, not like stickers you stick to the ceiling, but like on strings hanging these stars to create this kind of 3D space. And so I get up on this ladder and I'm trying to put this thing up, and I, you know, couldn't balance. And my wife, I was like, you know, hey, can you help me and hand me that stuff? And I'm putting this stuff up. And in the middle of this experience of hanging these stars, that little scene came to me of like, hey, we're making this home, we're making this universe, we're making this together. And so that was kind of based on that. So there's a bunch of things like that.
I still want to put you on the spot. Can we get you to read for us on your birthday?
You're such a punk, man.
I know. I really want to hear you start on page 4. So we were talking about the voice of Zabu. Zabu is going to tell this story about Prometheus. And I would just... let's just get you to read just a little bit. You don't have to read the
really?
Whole...
Oh, really? No, man. Do you not understand? So I had started like going through my book and like as to what I had issue with, and that's the thing. It literally,
that's so funny because this is...
You page, have an issue with that?
This is such a strong story,
really?
And it's such a key part of the initial, you know, initially...
It ignited me, yeah. I mean, when I started
page,
reading totally. It...
Page 4, it was like the first two paragraphs, it says here... Crap, fix this.
All right, well, let's see what our listeners say. Why don't you begin, Zabu, and tell us this story.
You want me to read the whole story? That's a pretty long story.
Now, just right, a little right, bit. Right. Maybe there's going to be a magic point where you stop.
Prometheus belonged to a race known as the Titans, the old gods, the fallen ones. Their power had been usurped by the gods of Olympus, but Prometheus disapproved of the new authority. He came to Zeus one day and asked, "You have created the race of man, yet you have kept him ignorant and forever in darkness. Does this not impair his ability to serve you?" With lightning flashing in his eyes and a booming voice, Zeus was quick in his reply. "I would be better served if you were to leave the concern of man to me. What you call his ignorance is his innocence. The darkness that you see is merely the shadow cast by my guiding hand. Look down upon man and you will find him huddled in caves, seeking shelter from beast and storm alike." Prometheus prodded again. "If this is meant to make the glory of your creation greater, I do not see how. Tell me why you deny man the gift of fire." "You have much to learn. Can you not see that every gift brings with it a curse? This is the way in which the universe balances itself. This is Janus's law, one that even we gods must obey. While it is true that man may not have fire or the crafts that fire makes possible, he also has known neither warfare nor a worried mind." Prometheus shook his head. "If he is to be forever limited, why separate him from the lesser creatures at all?" "Ah, because of his singular capacity to worship," said Zeus plainly. "Man is born with an innate awe at our power and glory." Zeus craned his neck as if admiring his own greatness. "Why, that is the very purpose for which we made him." Prometheus knew that Zeus, like all those who place themselves at the capstone of oligarchy, wanted to keep man subservient. Yet he sympathized with this strange race and asked, "Would not fire make him more interesting?" To appeal to Zeus's desire for praise, he added, "If only for your amusement."
That was an important passage for me. That was like the fourth Prometheus sink that I had in a matter of days when I started reading your book. And it was ignited. It was like a secret message that was given to me through you, because you had no idea what was going on in my mind. And actually, I think that, what was it, synchronized number 3?
Mm-hmm.
My little segment starts by commenting about that. So it's funny to me that you would want to change or correct it. What's wrong with it?
Oh, it's just the wording. I don't know. That's what's
so beautiful about it. The wording's so funny.
Thank you. Yeah.
Prometheus overcame his emotions and steeled himself for the task at hand. He spoke sharply with an air of finality. You have freed me, as per our agreement. I will now extend to you a gift more powerful than the atomic bomb. And so he did.
All right, I'm going to read again from the exegesis. This is 38:41. 1. The brain is an organizing principle. 2. It constantly assembles and distributes visual and audio messages. 3. These messages are the prime instrument of its organizing. 4. We are only subliminally aware of these messages. They are latent. 5. Via the messages, the brain coordinates us sentiently, draws us into itself, and frees us from the blind determinism. We are subsumed by it. It is sentient. Therefore, we are guided by sentience, not cause and effect or chance. Like your book, it seemed to have unlocked something in me. I mean, are there things that you've read in your book that have you see differently now? Like, how could I call that? That's not what my intent was.
But, you know, I guess. All right. So as far as what I would want to change in here, a lot of it is just wording. I mean, bear in mind, a lot of it was written in a rush. A lot of it was written in like very piecemeal. What I would do is I would go to a job and I would write on the subway on my way to work. I had this little notepad I carried with me. I'd write, you know, 3 paragraphs on the train going to work. Then I'd go to work and then I'd get a lunch break and I'd write a few paragraphs with my lunch break. Then I'd go back in, you know, then on my train ride home, I'd write a few paragraphs. And I never really got a chance to, like, reread what I would write. So a lot of times there's repetition of some, like, just, you know, you can look at a page and the same word is said 5 times on a page.
Yeah.
Shit like that bothers me. But it's not the story that I have issue with. The only thing that I still struggle with was the ending.
How about we talk about the ending another time when the book comes out?
Sure, yeah, okay.
Well, that was 42 minutes. Thanks for sharing it with us, Alan.
Yeah, thank you guys. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to Alan Abadesa Green on SyncBook Radio, a production of thesyncbook.com. More information about the work of Alan can be found at allthehappycreatures.com. For more information about the SyncBook, our guests, check out past shows, or to subscribe to the podcast via iTunes, please be sure and visit our website at 42minutes.com. If you'd like to support the show, we urge you to become a donor. You'll find the donation links under each episode on the website. Thank you so much, and truly, Happy New Year.
This came up as an answer at the last Radio 8 Ball Sync event we did in New York. Alan totally misinterpreted it, but I think he gets it now. Although, he didn't really misinterpret it, he sync interpreted it. I tried to be a good time guy, but I was ill-equipped. Guess I was pussy-whipped well before my prime. And you tried to give me love, but I didn't want your love. I wanted your action, and you. Well, you know that my songs ain't good, except when the times are bad, and all of the fun we had, you barely said a word. And now that seems so strange, you wanted my hand, and I wanted your action, I wanted your action, I wanted your action. Yeah, I wanted your action, I wanted your action. Oh, I wanted your action, honey, yeah. And now, while the world's asleep, except you and me, this moment I will take to whisper softly in your ear the words that I want to hear. Oh, show me some action, I want your action, I want your action. Ooh, I want your action, I want your action. Ooh, ooh.
daddy too. I'm talking about action, satisfaction. Pretty words ain't got no traction, hon. Why don't you show me the action? Now I want your action, honey, yeah.